He could not really grasp it, but he sensed the enormity of what she told him, and she saw it in his eyes. "Now you know our secret," she laughed. "If I have guessed right, we will double and redouble our fortune." "And if it doesn't change, if the..." He searched for the word. "If the depression goes on and on forever, what then, Mater?" She pouted and dropped her hands. "Then, Cherie, nothing will matter very much, one way or the other." She started the Daimler and drove up the last pitch of the road to the bungalow, standing alone in its wide lawns, with lights burning in the windows and the servants lined up respectfully on the front veranda in their immaculate white livery to welcome her. She parked at the bottom of the steps, turned off the engine, and turned to him again. "No, Chassacheri, we are not going to be poor. We are going to be rich, much richer than we ever were before. And then later, through you, my darling, we will have power to go with our wealth. Great fortune, enormous power. Oh, I have it all planned, so carefully planned." Her words filled Chassa's head with turbulent thoughts. He could not sleep. Great fortune, enormous power. The words excited and disturbed him. He tried to visualize what they meant, and saw himself like a strong man at the circus, in leopard skins and leather wristbands, standing with arms akimbo, huge biceps flexed upon a pyramid of golden sovereigns, while a congregation in white robes knelt and made obeisance before him. He ran the images through his head, over and over, each time altering some detail, all of them pleasurable, but lacking the final touch, until he bestowed upon one of his white-robed worshippers a crown of unruly, wind-tousled, sun-streaked curls. He placed her in the front rank, and she lifted her forehead from the ground and stuck her tongue out at him. His erection was so quick and hard that it made him gasp, and before he could prevent himself, he had slipped his hand under the sheet and prized it out of the fly of his pyjamas. Jock Murphy had warned him about it. "It will spoil your eye, Master Chassa. I have seen many a good man with a bat or a polo stick ruined by Mrs. Palm and her five daughters." But in his fantasy, Annalisa was sitting up, her long legs apart, and she was slowly drawing up the skirt of her white robe. The skin of her legs was smooth as butter, and he moaned softly. She was staring at the front of his leopard-skin costume, her tongue whisking lightly over her parted lips, and the white skirt rose higher and higher, and his fist began to jerk rhythmically. He could not prevent it. Up and up rode the white skirt, never quite reaching the fork of her crotch. Her legs seemed to stretch forever, like the railway tracks across the desert, running on and never meeting. He choked and jerked into a sitting position on the feather mattress, doubled over his flying fist, and when it came, it was sharp and painful as a bayonet driven up into his intestines, and he cried out and fell back against the pillows. Annalisa's sly, grinning, freckled face receded, and the wet front of his pyjamas began to turn icy cold. But he did not have the will to strip them off. When the servant woke him with a tray of coffee and a dish of hard, sweet rusks, he felt dazed and exhausted. It was still dark outside, and he rolled over and pulled the pillows over his head. "Madam, your mother, she says, I wait here until you get up," said the Ovambo servant darkly. And Chassa dragged himself to the bathroom, trying to conceal the dry stain on the front of his pyjamas. One of the grooms had his pony saddled and waiting at the front steps of the bungalow. Chassa took a moment to joke and laugh with the groom and then greet and caress his pony, rubbing foreheads with him and blowing softly into his nostrils. "You are getting fat, Prester John," he chided the pony. "We'll have to work that off you with the polo sticks." He swung up into the saddle and took the short cut, following the pipe track around the shoulder of the hill. The pipeline carried the water from the spring around the hills to the mine and the washing gear. He passed the pump house and felt a guilty pang at its associations with last night's depravity. But then the dawn lit the plains below the cliffs, and he forgot that in the pleasure of watching the veldt come alive and greet the sun. On this side of the hills, Santein had ordered that the forest be left untouched, and the Mopani was tall and stately. A covey of Francolin were dawn crying in the thicket down the slope, and a grey duiker, returning from the spring, bounded across the track under the pony's nose. Chasseur laughed as he shied theatrically. "Stop that, you old show-off!" He turned the corner of the cliff, and the contrast was depressing. The desecrated forest, the deforming scar of the workings on the hillside, the graceless square iron buildings, and the stark skeletal girders of the washing gear. How ugly they were! He gave the pony a touch with his heels, and they galloped the last mile, and reached the main haulage just as Twentyman Jones's old Ford came up the track from the village, with headlights still burning. He checked his watch as he stepped out, and looked sad as he saw that Chasseur was 3 minutes ahead of time. "Have you ever been down the haulage, Master Chasseur?" "No, sir." He was going to add, "My mater has never allowed it," but somehow that seemed superfluous, and for the first time he felt a twinge of resentment at his mother's all-pervading presence. Twentyman Jones led him to the head of the haulage and introduced him to the shift boss. "Master Chasseur will be working with you," he explained. "Treat him normally, just like you would treat any other young man who will one day be your managing director," he instructed. It was impossible to tell by Twentyman Jones's expression when he was joking, so nobody laughed. "Get a tin helmet for him," Twentyman Jones ordered, and while Chasseur adjusted the straps of the helmet, he led him to the foot of the sheer cliff. The inclined tunnel had been cut into the base of the cliff, a round aperture into which the steel rail tracks angled downwards at 45 degrees, before disappearing into the dark depths. A string of cocoa pans stood at the head of the tracks, and Twentyman Jones led him to the first truck, and they climbed into the steel bin. The shift swarmed into the trucks behind them, a dozen white foremen and 150 black workers in ragged, dusty overalls and helmets of bright, unpainted metal, laughing and ragging each other in boisterous horseplay. The steam winch of the winding gear clattered and hissed, and the string of trucks jerked forward and then, rocking and swaying, ran down the steeply inclined ramp on the narrow gauge railway tracks. The steel wheels, rumbling and clacking over the joints in the track, they dropped down into the dark maw of the tunnel. Chasseur stirred uneasily, stabbed with unreasoning fear at the sudden absolute blackness that engulfed them. However, in the trucks behind him, the Ovambo miners were singing, their deep, melodious voices echoing in the dark confines of the tunnel, a marvellous chorus raised in an African work chant. And Chasseur relaxed and leaned closer to Twentyman Jones to follow his explanation. "The incline is 45 degrees, and the capacity of the winding gear is 100 tons. In mining parlance, that is 60 loads of ore. Our target is 600 loads a shift raised to the surface." Chasseur was trying to concentrate on the figures. He knew his mother would question him this evening, but the darkness and singing and the rumble of the swaying trucks distracted him. Ahead of him there was a tiny coin of brilliant white light that grew swiftly in size until abruptly they burst out of the far end of the tunnel, and involuntarily Chasseur gasped with astonishment. He had studied the diagrams of the pipe, and of course they were photographs on his mother's desk at Veldt Vreden, but they had not adequately prepared him for its immensity. It was an almost perfectly round hole in the centre of the hills. It was open to the sky, and the sides of the excavation were vertical and sheer, a circular wall of grey rock like a cockpit. They had entered it through the tunnel that connected the workings to the far side of the hills, and the narrow ramp on which they were riding continued down at the same angle of 45 degrees until it reached the floor of the excavation 200 feet below them. The drop on either hand was breathtaking. The great rock-lined hole was a mile across and its sheer walls 400 feet from the tip to the floor. Twentyman Jones was still lecturing him. "This is a volcanic pipe, a blowhole from the earth's depths, up which the molten magma was forced to the surface in the beginning of time. In those temperatures, as hot as the sun, and enormous pressures, the diamonds were forged, and they were brought up in the fiery lava." Shassa stared around him, screwing his head to take in the proportions of the huge excavation, as Twentyman Jones went on. "Then the pipe was pinched off at depth, and the magma in it cooled and solidified. The upper layer, exposed to air and sun, was oxidized in the classical yellow ground of the diamondiferous formation. We worked down through that for 11 years, and only recently we reached the blue ground." He made an expansive gesture that took in the slaty blue rock that formed the floor of the huge pit. "That is the deeper deposit of the solidified magma, hard as iron, and as full of diamonds as currants in a hot cross bun." They reached the floor of the workings and climbed down from the truck. "The operation is fairly straightforward," Twentyman Jones went on. "The new shift comes in at first light and begins work on the previous evening's blast. The broken ground is lashed and loaded into the cocoa pans and sent up the haulage to the surface. After that, they mark out and drill the shot holes for the next blast, and then they set the charges. At dusk, we pull out the shift, and the shift boss lights the fuses. After the blast, we leave the workings overnight to settle and for the fumes to disperse. Then, the next morning, we begin the whole process over again. There," he pointed to an area of shattered blue-grey rock, "that's last night's blast. That's where we will begin today." Shassa had not expected to be so absorbed by the fascination of this mighty excavation, but his interest grew more intense as the day went on. Not even the heat and the dust daunted him. The heat was trapped between the sheer walls when at noon the sun beat down directly onto the uneven broken floor. The dust was floury, rising from the shattered ore body as the hammermen swung their 10-pound sledges to crack the larger lumps into manageable pieces. The dust hung in a fog over the lashing teams as they loaded the cocoa pans, and it coated their faces and their bodies and turned them into ghostly grey albinos. "We get a bit of miner's phthisis," Twentyman Jones admitted. "The dust gets into their lungs and turns to stone. Ideally, we should hose the ore down and keep it wet to lay the dust, but we're short of water. We haven't enough for the washing gear. We certainly can't afford to splash it around. So men die and are crippled, but it takes 10 years to build up in the lungs. And we give them or their widows a good pension. And the miner's inspector is sympathetic, though his sympathy costs a penny." At noon, Twentyman Jones called Shassa across. "Your mother said you need only work half the shift. I'm going up now. Are you coming?" "I'd rather not, sir," Shassa answered diffidently, I'd like to watch them charge the holes for the blast. Twentyman Jones shook his head sorrowfully. Chip off the old block. And he went away, still muttering. The shift bus allowed Chasser to light the fuses under his careful supervision. It gave Chasser a sense of importance and power to touch the flaring Chisa stick, the igniter, to the bunch tips of the fuses, passing quickly down the line and watching the fire run down the twisted white fuses, turning them sizzling black in the swirl of blue smoke. He and the shift boss rode up on the haulage to the cry of "Fire in the hole!" And Chasser lingered at the head of the main haulage until the shots fired, and he felt the earth tremble beneath his feet. Then he saddled Prester John, and dusty, streaked with sweat, bone-tired and happy, as he had seldom been in his life, he rode back along the pipe track. He was not even thinking about her when he reached the pump house, but there she was, perched up on top of the silver-painted water pipe. The shock was such that when Prester John shied under him, he almost lost his seat and had to snatch at the pommel. She had plaited a wreath of wild flowers into her hair and unbuttoned the top of her blouse. In one of the books in the library at Veldhoven, there was an illustration of satyrs and nymphs dancing in the forest. The book was kept in the forbidden section to which his mother guarded the key. But Chasser had invested some of his pocket money in a duplicate, and lightly clad nymphs were among his favourites of all that treasure house of erotica. Annalisa was one of these, a wood nymph, only part human, and she slanted her eyes at him slyly, and her eye teeth were pointed and very white. "Hello, Annalisa." His voice cracked treacherously, and his heart was beating so wildly that he thought it might spring under his throat and choke him. She smiled, but did not reply. Instead, she caressed her own arm, a slow, lingering stroke from her wrist to her bare shoulder. He watched her fingers raising the fine coppery hair on her forearm, and his loins swelled. She leaned forward and placed her forefinger on her lower lip, still grinning slyly. And her bosom changed shape, and the opening of her blouse gaped, and he saw the skin in the V was so white and translucent that the tiny blue veins showed through it. He kicked out of the stirrups and swung a leg over Prester John's withers in the showy polo player's forward dismount. But the girl whirled to her feet, hoisted her skirts high, and with a flash of creamy thighs, sprang lightly over the pipeline and disappeared into the thick scrub on the hillside beyond. Chasser raced after her and found himself struggling through dense undergrowth. It clawed at his face and seized his legs. He heard her giggle once, not far ahead of him, but a rock twisted under his boot and he fell heavily, winding himself. When he pulled himself up and limped after her, she was gone. A while longer, he floundered around in the scrub, his ardour swiftly cooling, and by the time he battled his way back to the pipe track, to find that Prester John had taken full advantage of the diversion and decamped, he was bubbling over with anger at himself and the girl. It was a long tramp back to the bungalow, and he hadn't realised how tired he was. It was dark by the time he got home. The pony, with empty saddle, had raised the alarm, and Santaine's concern changed instantly to relieved fury when she saw him. A week in the heat and dust of the workings and the monotony of the work began to pall. So Twentyman Jones sent Chasser to work in the winch room of the main haulage. The winch driver was a taciturn, morose man and jealous of his job. He would not allow Chasser to touch the controls of the winch. My union doesn't allow it. He stood his ground stubbornly. And after 2 days, Twentyman Jones moved Shasser to the weathering ground. Here the ore was tipped out and spread in the open by gangs of Ovambo labourers, all stripped to the waist and chanting in chorus as they went through the laborious repetitive process of tip and spread under the urgings of their white supervisor and his gang of black boss boys. On this weathering ground lay the stockpile of the Harney mine. Thousands of tons of ore spread out on an area the size of 4 polo fields. When the blue ground was blasted out of the pipe, it was hard as concrete. Only gelignite and the 10-pound sledgehammers would break it. But after it had been lying in the sun on the weathering ground for 6 months, it began to break down and crumble until it was chalky and friable and could be reloaded into the coker pans and taken to the mill and the washing gear. Shasser was placed in charge of a gang of 40 labourers and soon struck up a friendship with the Ovambo boss boy. Like all the black tribesmen, he had two names, his tribal name, which he did not divulge to his white employers, and his work name. The Ovambo's work name was Moses. He was 15 years or so older than the other boss boys and had been selected for his intelligence and initiative. He spoke both English and Afrikaans well, and the respect that the black labourers usually reserved for the grey hair of age he earned from them with his billy club and boot and acid wit. "If I was a white man," he told Shasser, "one day I would have Doc Teller's job." Doc Teller was the Ovambo name for Twentyman Jones, and Moses went on, "I might still have it one day, or if not me, then my son." Shasser was shocked and then intrigued by such an outrageous notion. He had never before met a black who did not know his place in society. There was a disturbing presence about the tall Ovambo, who looked like one of the drawings of an Egyptian pharaoh from the forbidden section of the Veldt of Reden library. But that hint of danger made him much more intriguing to Shasser. They usually spent the lunch hour break together, Shasser helping Moses to perfect his reading and writing in the grubby ruled notebook, which was his most prized possession. In return, the Ovambo taught Shasser the rudiments of his language, especially the oaths and insults, and the meaning of some of the work chants, most of which were ribald. "Is baby-making work or pleasure?" was the rhetorical opening question of Shasser's favourite chant. And he joined in the response to the delight of the gang he was supervising. "It cannot be work, or the white man would make us do it for him." Shasser was just over 14 years old. Some of the men he supervised were 3 times his age, and none of them thought it strange. Instead, they responded to his teasing and his sunny smile and his sorry attempts to speak their language. His men were soon spreading 5 loads to 4 of the other teams, and they ended the second week as top gang on the grounds. Shasser was too involved with the work and his new friend to notice the dark looks of the white supervisor. And even when he made a pointed remark about the Kaffir boys, or nigger lovers, Shasser did not take the reference personally. On the third Saturday, after the men had been paid at noon, he rode down to the boss boy's cottage at Moses' invitation and spent an hour sitting in the sun on the front doorstep of the cottage, drinking sour milk from the calabash that Moses' shy and pretty young wife offered, and helping him read aloud from the copy of Macaulay's History of England he had smuggled out of the bungalow and brought down in his saddlebag. The book was one of his set works at school, so Shasser considered himself something of an authority on it, and he was enjoying the unusual role of teacher and instructor until at last Moses closed the book. "This is very heavy work, good water." He had translated Shasta's name directly into the Ovambo. "Worse than spreading ore in the summer. I will work on it later." And he went into the single-room cottage, placed the book in his locker, and came back with a roll of newspaper. "Let us try this." He offered the paper to Shasta, who spread it on his lap. It was poor quality yellow newsprint, and the ink smudged under his fingers. The name on the top of the page was Umlomo wa Bantu, and Shasta translated it without difficulty, "The Mouth of the Black Nations." And he glanced down the columns of print. The articles were mostly in English, though there were a few in the vernacular. Moses pointed out the editorial, and they started working through it. "What is the African National Congress?" Shasta was puzzled. "And who is Jabavu?" Eagerly, the Ovambo began to explain, and Shasta's interest turned to unease as he listened. "Jabavu is the father of the Bantu, of all the tribes, of all the black people. The African National Congress is the herder who guards our cattle." "I don't understand." Shasta shook his head. He did not like the direction that the discussion was taking. And he began to squirm as Moses quoted, "Your cattle are gone, my people. Go rescue them, go rescue them. Leave your breech loader and turn instead to the pen. Take paper and ink, for that will be your shield. Your rights are going, so take up your pen, load it with ink, and do battle with the pen." "That is politics," Shasta interrupted him. "Blacks don't take part in politics. That's white man's business." This was the cornerstone of the South African way of life. The glow went out of Moses' expression, and he lifted the newspaper off Shasta's lap and stood up. "I will return your book to you when I have read it." He avoided Shasta's eyes and went back into the cottage. On the Monday, 20 men Jones stopped Shasta at the main gate of the Weathering Grounds. "I think you have learned all there is to know about weathering, Master Shasta. It's about time we moved you along to the mill house and the washing gear." As they followed the railway tracks up to the main plant, walking beside one of the coca pans which was full of the crumbling weathered ore, 20 men Jones remarked, "It is just as well not to become too familiar with the black labourers, Master Shasta. You will find they tend to take advantage if you do." Shasta was puzzled for a moment, and then he laughed. "Oh, you mean Moses? He isn't a labourer. He is a boss boy, and he's jolly bright, sir." "A bit too bright for his own good," 20 men Jones agreed bitterly. "The bright ones are always the malcontents and trouble-stirrers. Give me an honest dumb nigger every time. Your friend Moses is trying to organize a black mine workers' union." Shasta knew from his grandfather and his mother that Bolsheviks and trade unionists were the most dreaded monsters, intent on tearing down the framework of civilized society. He was appalled to learn that Moses was one of these. But 21 Jones was going on. "We also suspect that he is at the center of a nice little IDB operation." IDB was the other monster of civilized existence. Illicit diamond buying. The trade in stolen diamonds. And Shasta was revolted by the idea that his friend could be both a trade unionist and an illicit dealer. Yet 20 men Jones's next words depressed him.